It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a national conversation about law enforcement was sparked when a police officer shot and killed an unarmed black teen in August in Ferguson, Missouri. We'll talk to a policing expert about President Obama's new plans to help create more trust between law enforcement and minority communities.
First, yesterday was World AIDS Day, and organizations around the globe marked December as a month dedicated to raising awareness about HIV and AIDS. This month, two Wisconsinites, Jason Genders and Charles Smart of the AIDS Resource Center in Wisconsin, have been named to the PAS 100, a list of 100 people worldwide who are working to end the spread of HIV.
This year, the list focuses on youth power and highlights people under the age of 30. According to PAS magazine, quoting here, for more than three decades, HIV/AIDS has been fought mostly by folks who are already adults when the epidemic began. In that time, a new generation has entered adulthood, having only heard stories of the early days and never knowing a world without HIV. This new generation of advocates is fighting HIV/AIDS for a variety of reasons, but regardless of their motivation, these young people could be the ones to finally put an end to AIDS.
Here in Wisconsin, HIV is a particular challenge in Milwaukee County. In the state, the rate of infection is 3 in 100,000, which is comparable to the national average. But in Milwaukee County, it's 22 in 100,000. Both Charles Smart and Jason Genders are based in Milwaukee. Charles is a supervisor of the Many Men, Many Voices program at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. Charles, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you for having me, and thank you to your listeners as well.
And Jason Genders is a pharmacist with the center. Jason, thank you for joining us.
Thank you guys very much for having me on air today.
Well, Charles, let's start with you. Can you describe the work that you do right now with the AIDS Resource Center?
Absolutely. So I supervise a combination of interventions and public health strategies designed to reach MSM, or men who have sex with men, and engage them into prevention services.
Now, this is the group that has numbers going up in terms of infection. It's a group of young men. What are you trying to do within this community?
Well, what we're really trying to do, specifically with our Many Men, Many Voices intervention, is engage groups of men in conversations around safer sex behaviors and help them come up with plans designed to reduce their likelihood of acquiring HIV infections.
And Jason, you work on the care side of fighting HIV once people already have it. What is your line of work? What are you doing right now?
So, Veronica, what I do is I'm actually a pharmacist supervisor at the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin Pharmacy. So we take care of patients on a day-to-day basis that both use our medical clinic at our ARCW locations as well as outside clinics. And our goal is really to make sure our patients have the best possible access to medications. So we help our patients overcome barriers such as income. We help them with their co-payments if they need it. We help them physically access the medications if they're located in an area where they don't have a lot of pharmacies near them. We use UPS and we use courier drivers to get our medications to our patients, especially during these terrible winter months where the roads aren't so good. We also work very closely with our patients to empower them to get the most out of their medications. So educating them about HIV and how it affects the body and how the medications can help our patients live happier, healthier lives.
Now, both of you, I guess you could be called second wave workers in HIV prevention and care work. So having come in, not growing up with the first wave of it, how did you both get involved and become passionate about it? And Charles, let's start with you.
Well, it was back in 2007 when, you know, before the CDC came in and investigated the increase in HIV infections among young black MSM in Milwaukee, and really identified that we had prevalent infections and we had determined that there was a true increase in HIV infections that disproportionately impacted black, gay, and bisexual men. Before they came in and really did their investigation in 2007, I really was seeing the impact. I had friends who were going to get tested and they came back HIV positive. And so it truly moved me to do something about this, and that's when I began to get involved.
And Jason, how about you?
So, Veronica, I was fortunate enough when I was in my last year of pharmacy school to have a rotation, an 8-week rotation at a small specialty pharmacy where I met some really great pharmacists, Nichols and Rick Fons and Nicole Lentz, and I got to see the relationship that they had with their HIV-positive patients and saw some of the barriers that they overcame with their patients to really make a strong difference in their lives and to really form, you know, great positive relationships where they truly made just a tremendous amount of headway with improving their patients' health care. And I just fell in love with, you know, the kind of dedication and the challenges that they worked to overcome with their patients. And once they opened up a pharmacy over at the AIDS Resource Center and they called me up, I had to join. And I've been really happy I have ever since.
Now, the both of you work in Milwaukee County, which has a higher rate of infection than the rest of Wisconsin. What challenges, Charles, come with working in Milwaukee County?
Well, there are significant challenges around some of the barriers of health in general among communities of color, housing, employment, and food, that, you know, makes it an interesting a job and mission to go out and really engage folks.
And Jason, you said that you've never looked back, more or less. This is something that you love now. What is it about working with HIV and AIDS patients that speaks to you, that really fulfills your need to help?
Yeah, that's a good question, Veronica. And I think the thing that really draws me to it is you walk in and you'll meet your patients at a point in their life where they're more than likely very vulnerable. I mean, they may have just found out about their diagnosis. They may be scared. They may be unsure of, you know, the stigma that's out there. They, you know, may be working with family issues. There's a lot of deep struggles that an HIV-positive individual has to overcome. And to be there for those patients during those times and to see them through those difficult times and to connect them to resources that are available here at ARCW, whether it be case management, medical, legal, food pantry, behavioral health. There's so many different services we are able to provide for our patients here at ARCW. So I love the challenge and the opportunity to really make a good impact in their lives and to work with, you know, a large group of, you know, professionals from different backgrounds to help our patients really overcome any barriers and see them succeed. You know, it's great to see a patient that you first started working with 3 years ago and they were scared and they were, you know, not sure if they could get through it, to really see them succeed and become undetectable with their HIV viral load and to just really be thriving. It's a great reward.
Now, you've both been named to the PAS 100. This is a list of 100 people from all over the world who are fighting HIV and AIDS. And Charles, what does that distinction mean to you?
Well, it's an honor, and honestly, it's truly a recognition of all of the efforts throughout this state and the leadership aimed at moving us closer to a generation free of new HIV incidents and AIDS.
And Jason?
You know, I really want to echo what Charles is saying, Veronica. I mean, it really is, you know, it's the next step, and we've got medications out there that can really treat HIV very well. It is really becoming more of a chronic disease state, and, you know, we just, as the newer generation, need to stay focused on getting tested to know your status, and if you are positive, you know someone else that's positive, and they are scared or confused about where to go, please keep us in mind, get them connected into care, because if we can get them on treatment and they can do well with it, not only do they live a happier, healthier life, they also have a much lower risk of spreading HIV to their loved ones or others in the community, which is just a great benefit. So it was an honor. It's a reminder of where we are and where we have to go. And it made my mom smile during Thanksgiving dinner, so that was nice too.
Well, looking forward, what work do you feel like still needs to be done in Milwaukee? What would you like to see accomplished in the next few years or so? Charles, let's go to you.
Well, on the heels of World AIDS Day, which the theme was to focus, partner, achieve an AIDS-free generation, we really need to begin to coordinate our response to the HIV epidemic locally in line with the priorities and goals set out in the National HIV/AIDS Strategy and develop smart strategic partnerships designed to address those barriers to health in communities of color that I was talking about. And we will achieve this, I'm sure, if our processes are informed by the communities we're aiming to reach.
And Jason, we'll give you the last word.
Yeah, Veronica, I think that in Milwaukee County and a lot of our patients, they have a lot of different issues going on. We have to worry about getting them stable housing. We have to worry about really increasing our testing efforts and getting people to get tested. And if they, you know, determine that they are positive, that they get connected to care. It's really still about education in the community, I think. And just like Charles said, I mean, we really want to make coordinated strategic efforts to educate the population, to make sure everyone's aware of HIV and the importance of getting tested. You know, it really, we've come a long way, but we still have a long way to go.
Jason and Charles, thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Charles Smart and Jason Genders of the AIDS Resource Center of Wisconsin. They were named to the PAWS 100 this month, a list of 100 people around the world who are under 30 and are working to end HIV and AIDS. Now we're focusing on the president's comments on policing yesterday. People from across the country have been protesting against law enforcement since a grand jury decided not to indict a police officer who shot and killed an unarmed teen. Yesterday, President Obama announced the creation of a new task force on police and community relations, as well as funding for body cameras for police officers and new rules for military-style equipment used in police departments.
Michael Scott is with us now to talk about what the president had to say. He's the director of the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing, a nonprofit organization that works to improve police effectiveness and fairness. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Well, one of the things the president said yesterday is that he wants to avoid a militarized culture in local police departments across the country. Do you think this is a problem, that we have this kind of culture in some community police departments?
Certainly is. It's not new, this trend toward militarization of some, not all, but many police departments began really as far back as the 1980s, and as a response to, at that time, the war on drugs, especially the crack cocaine epidemic. And so there has been a steady increase in the adoption by local police of military weaponry, tactics, uniforms, and approaches to dealing with a number of street crime problems. So this is not a brand new issue.
And while the president says he doesn't want to militarize culture, he says he's not necessarily wanting to crack down on federal military style equipment going to police departments. So is it the gear or is it the training that's part of the militarized culture? Or is it a little of both?
Well, it's a little of both. We do have to keep in mind that the police are and always have been a paramilitary institution. There's nothing inherently wrong with some aspects of a military bearing and military discipline. They have their place in policing. The concern is when that approach and that look and that culture really begins to dominate and to dominate the more civil side of policing. So it really is not just a question of what equipment they have, but what equipment is visibly publicly displayed, is used in inappropriate circumstances, how the police officers appear to the general public in routine policing. There's a lot of different issues associated with this military culture.
So are there police departments in the country that have tackled this issue and said, hey, we need to draw the line, not to look so much like a paramilitary operation and do some things you talked about with a community-first approach?
Well, there's actually an interesting case study right in Wisconsin, and in the department I know best, the Madison Police Department. If you go back to the late 1960s and early 1970s, when Chief David Cooper first became chief in Madison, he made a concerted effort to demilitarize the appearance of the Madison police precisely to allay and to reduce some of the tension with the community in the wake of the anti-war riots. And so there has been a concerted effort in the city of Madison, but many, many departments around the country began to follow suit and follow Madison's lead on that. But in intervening years, again, since the 1980s, there's been more of a creep back toward the militarized look of police.
So does doing something like making a presidential statement, starting a task force, funding training at the federal level start to address these problems, or is this something that has to happen from the bottom up at the local level?
Well, policing in the United States is fundamentally a local function, and the federal government can play a role. These sorts of national commissions, we've had them repeatedly throughout our nation's history since we've had organized police. We had no fewer than five of these national commissions in the late 1960s through the early 1970s, including taking a look at the police response to urban rioting and police contribution to those riots. So there are some positive things that can come out of presidential attention to these issues, but ultimately the changes must occur at the local level.
Is there going to be resistance at the local level from police chiefs, maybe even mayors and city councils who want their policing to go a particular way?
I don't think so. I recently attended a meeting of a couple of hundred police chiefs here in Chicago, many of them really focusing on the rioting in Ferguson and other similar incidents around the country. And almost to a person, these chiefs were fairly eager to take steps that will be necessary to improve police working relationships with minority communities.
We're talking to policing expert Mike Scott now about President Obama's new rules on police equipment and things he wants to see change in police-community relationships in light of the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri, and around the country.
We're taking your calls now. Do you think the president went far enough in working to repair distrust between police and minority communities? Do you think body cameras are a good idea for police officers? What about military equipment for officers? And what changes would increase your trust in law enforcement? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion with Mike Scott of the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing about the president's new standards on police gear, training, and community relations.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the president's comments about law enforcement? Do you think he went enough to restore trust in law enforcement? What would you like to see change when it comes to policing, maybe in your community? Do you think something like body cameras would be a good idea for police officers? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Before we go to callers, Mike, I wanted to ask you about that idea of body cameras for police officers. A lot of the protesters, including the family of the deceased in that Ferguson, Missouri case, saying, hey, we need this. The president offering funding for it. How much are these used already, and what kind of difference have they made, if any?
Well, they were first introduced by the British police maybe about 10 years ago. So the British and the Scottish police have a little bit of experience with these. American police began maybe about 5-6 years ago to experiment with them. So at this point, the momentum's already underway, and was even before the Ferguson incident, for American police to begin to adopt these body cameras and to experiment with them. I would say most of the major cities are now at least experimenting with body cameras. And so we don't have definitive answers about what impact they have, but we do have some tentative information.
So what kind of tentative information? What are some of the first signals from the use of these?
Well, that there are some promising effects. It looks like they do have the capacity to change and improve both the police officer's behavior as well as civilians' behavior in interactions with police. And that's all to the good if that holds up. There's some potential to reduce frivolous complaints that some civilians make against police officers. And there's some possibility that could reduce some of the what we might think of as unnecessary arrests made by officers.
Have we seen downside to them?
Well, there's still a lot of fairly significant concerns, some of them relating to privacy, both the privacy of civilians who are being recorded and having their behavior, oftentimes not at their best, recorded and maybe made public, privacy issues for the police officer. There are also concerns about the public records that will be created and who's going to be able to watch these videos. and under what circumstances. And, of course, we're not entirely sure how having a camera present in all of these police interactions might distort in a negative way the behavior and the actions of both police officers and civilians. So there's good potential, and there's some concerning potential as well.
Well, let's go to our callers now. We've got Stephen on the line in Fountain City. Stephen, hi.
Hi. It's great to be on with you guys.
What do you think, Stephen?
Well, I just wanted to say I noticed a few times that there were talk of, like, police officers in car cameras. They would shut them off before they, you know, abuse people or whatever. But as far as the body cameras, I think that the same problem could arise. And I just think it would make a lot more sense if dispatchers were controlling when the body cameras were actually turned on and when they were turned off so that there could be no tampering.
Stephen, thanks for the call. Is that something that anybody's doing, letting someone other than the officer, him or herself, control the body camera, Mike?
Well, I haven't heard of that being done, but I think that's a very thoughtful suggestion. And one of the kinds of things that, experimentation with the cameras would help to shed some light on. I think somebody ought to try doing that and see what impact that has.
Stephen, thanks for the call. We'll go to Mike in Algoma now. Mike, hi.
Good morning, or good afternoon. My question has to do with lethal force. What happened to the use of stun guns and beanbags and other non-lethal ways of stopping a potential lawbreaker?
Mike, thanks for the call. Mike, what do you think? Have we seen a trend, any kind of trend away from non-lethal enforcement measures?
No, actually, the trend, I think, has continued in the favor of developing less than lethal weaponry. That most people are familiar with the brand name Taser, and that is the brand of stun gun, as the last caller described it, that's being fairly extensively used by police around the country. And most of the, although there are some concerns about the potential lethal effects, unintended lethal effects of tasers, there's also been an awful lot of positive benefit that's come out of their use.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We've got Daryl on the line now in Couderay. Daryl, hi.
Hi, thank you for the program. I think the president spoke out and Eric Holder spoke out. Then they both went to the sidelines in this game of death on people of color. It's a sad day in America for all in the end, I think.
Daryl, thanks for the call. So Mike Scott, he's saying President Obama needs to not make this announcement and step back, but keep rolling on this issue, I guess.
Well, he, from what I heard the president say, he said he intended to stick with it. You know, that's remains to be seen if that's going to be possible for him. He's the president of the United States with an awful lot to be concerned with, and he's going to delegate most of this work to this commission. Mm-hmm. But so long as he comes back to the issue and hears from the commission from time to time, that's really what's needed from the president.
Well, let's look at that commission now that the president announced, chaired by Philadelphia Police Commissioner Charles Ramsey and Lori Robinson. She's a professor, a former assistant attorney general at the Justice Department. What kind of message do we get from those two being picked to lead this effort?
Well, I know both individuals are both high-quality people. They're both well-known in the police field. They've got good reputations and good standing. And I think it at least sends a signal that the president has given some careful thought to who ought to be leading this commission.
Now, policing, as you said, happens mostly at the local level. Does that mean we end up with a patchwork where some people, some communities are doing great, others are doing worse? Is it useful to try to get a national standard to which all of those have to adhere?
Well, patchwork is more or less what we've had since the 1840s when we first began creating American police departments. Has never been otherwise in this country, possibly never will. But there have been some important moves toward national standards, accreditation standards that are voluntary but abided by many police agencies. There's a lot of effort on the part of most police agencies in this country to try to adopt what are considered model or best practices, even if they're not mandated by the federal government.
Another announcement yesterday from Attorney General Eric Holder saying the Justice Department is going to announce updated guidance for a profiling in an effort to end racial profiling. Do you see any major changes coming out of that announcement?
Well, that too is an issue that has been on the police agenda for several decades now, even going back to just prior to 9/11, that was racial profiling was the number one concern. And so there has been some positive movement in terms of developing police policies to prohibit racial profiling, improving police training to acknowledge and understand the subconscious bias that may go into policing. But clearly a lot more work needs to be done on that front.
Now, you work and you've worked for some time on the concept of problem-oriented policing. What is that, and how would it inform some of the issues we've been talking about?
Well, it actually stems relates quite directly to these issues, and that the whole idea, which was developed at the University of Wisconsin Law School, was to move the police away from an excessive reliance on criminal arrest and prosecution as the sole means of achieving policing objectives, and to develop alternatives to those the use of force and the use of coercion to achieve police objectives. That's a lot of what the problem-oriented approach encourages, and to the extent that we can get police to reduce their reliance on criminal arrest and prosecution, that has great potential to reduce some of the tension, the underlying tension that is giving rise to the unrest in many minority communities.
Who takes the lead in making that kind of transition happen?
Well, the police have to take the lead because it's essentially a call for a reform to the way in which police think about their job, organize themselves, and the kinds of strategies and tactics they adopt. So police have to take the lead, but not to do so alone. It was intended to be an approach that engaged the community very directly in identifying and resolving the public safety problems that exist in every community.
Well, maybe we can dig a little deeper into that sometime in the future. Mike, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Michael Scott. He's director of the Center for Problem-Oriented Policing. That's a nonprofit organization that works to improve police effectiveness and fairness. With us to talk about the president's new guidance on police gear, tactics, funding of body cameras for law enforcement. We're looking into a new investigative report about the criminal justice system here in Wisconsin. An examination into two similar cases shows that even though both inmates committed similar crimes, they received very different treatment from the system.
Here to look at how differently these two men were treated and why is Gina Barton. She's a criminal justice investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Gina, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Well, let's get a rundown on these cases that you wrote about. First is the case of Ramiah Whiteside. What happened to him? Why did he wind up in the system?
When he was 19 years old, which was about 20 years ago, he went joyriding in a stolen Cadillac, and he lost control, fleeing from the police, plowed through a bus stop shelter, and then the car exploded, and four people were killed.
And what kind of sentence did he get?
He got the maximum sentence at the time, which was 47 years in prison, and he was sentenced under the old parole system. So he was eligible for parole after serving about 12 years.
And it sounds as though the sentencing judge would have liked to add more time.
The sentencing judge was just incensed that the prosecutors hadn't charged him with more serious crimes and said if he could, he would have ordered even more time than the 47 years. That's correct.
And you put him alongside a similar case. This time we look at Shane Ernest. Why did he wind up in prison?
Shane was involved in a drunken driving accident in Buffalo County. And so he was under the influence and tried to pass another car in a no passing zone and caused a head on collision. And in that crash, three people were killed and two others were seriously injured.
And so compare these two men side by side. You know, they went through the system. First, before we go further, what kind of sentence did Ernest end up with?
He got a five-year sentence, and he was sentenced under truth in sentencing, which meant he was going to do 5 years, period, the end.
Okay, so you've got these two men, similar crimes. How do you see them when you put them side by side?
Well, I think it was really interesting that these two men shared a cell for about 6 to 8 months, and so they got to know each other, and they kind of became friends once they realized how starkly similar their crimes were. And at that time, Ramiah Whiteside, the guy who got the 47 years, had already been there for a while. He's African-American. And Shane, who was this young Caucasian kid, had never been in trouble before, kind of didn't know what he was doing in prison. And, you know, Ramiah kind of helped him get used to things and kind of took him under his wing a little bit and helped him through his incarceration.
I'm going to fast forward a little bit and tell us where they both are today.
So Shane's been out almost 5 years now. He's married. He has a baby. And he has a job doing small engine repair, lawnmowers and things like that. Ramiah now has been in almost 20 years and just got denied for parole again, despite the fact that one of his victims' mothers and his former cellmate Shane and even Judge Hancher, who sentenced him, have all said they believed he is reformed and he should be getting parole.
And one of the things that you point to when you look at the discrepancies in the way these cases turned out is Wisconsin's truth in sentencing law. So how did that come into play when we look at these two men?
So under truth in sentencing, as I said, whatever sentence the judge hands down, that's how long you get. So Shane was sentenced to 5 years. He served his 5 years. He's out. Ramiah was sentenced under the old parole system, where he was eligible for parole after 12 years and was sentenced to 47. And so the issue that a lot of people who were sentenced under the old law are having is that in the past few years, paroles have come to a virtual standstill. So even though the judge at the time in a lot of these cases realized that, yes, if this person was rehabilitated, he would be eligible for parole, people just aren't getting paroled. It's down from about 1,200 a few years ago to around 150 last year.
Now, Ramiah Whiteside had a longer criminal history. Shane Ernest, that was more or less one of the first things that got him into the system. Did that play a part?
It certainly did. I mean, Shane, it was the first thing he had ever done to get in trouble. And Ramiah had, in fact, already served prison time. And I'm hearing from a lot of readers about this. They're saying, well, these weren't similar crimes. Look at their previous records. And the point that I'm trying to make is, no, they didn't have similar records, but they did have similar crimes. And the question is, two questions. One is, were the records so dissimilar that one warrants 5 years and one warrants almost 50, you know, almost 10 times longer? Was his record that much worse? And then the second question is rehabilitation a goal of prison? And if so, virtually everyone agrees that Ramiah has been rehabilitated. So why is he still there?
Well, let's talk about that rehabilitation, because Ramiah had gotten counseling for substance abuse, some cognitive therapy, it sounds like. He seems committed in the piece to making a positive difference. Walk us through some of the things that he's done.
He said the most, the thing that had the greatest impact on him was this cognitive rehabilitation, which is a prison program where he spent 22 months learning how to adjust his thinking. And when he went in, he was 19, and now he's 39. So he's grown up a lot in addition to being taught the skills of, you know, empathy and thinking about the impact your actions have on other people and things like that. He finished his high school equivalency. He's done as many college credits as he possibly can pay for while in prison. He did a domestic violence, you know, prevention program, even though he had no history of domestic violence. And in fact, back in 2006, helped start an aftercare program for other people who had gone through that, you know, how to change criminal thinking so that they could keep supporting each other.
And you talked to Ramiah. He said one of the hardest things for him was the parole off process for him. He hasn't been able to get parole. And the other man you profile, Shane Earnest, he did get parole. And meanwhile, Ramiah doesn't see an end. He doesn't see, he sees uncertainty going forward. How do you see that playing a role in what he's gone through?
Well, and, you know, as I said, Shane, under truth in sentencing, didn't have to worry about parole or not. He was just, he had a date certain when he was getting out. And for Ramiah and other people like him, they talk about have they been rehabilitated and have they served an adequate amount of time and have they done all the programs that they need to do. And so their problems with that are the parole board might say, well, you need this program. But then the committee inside the prison will say, well, sorry, there's no room for you in this program. And then there's no way that they can do it. And so they come up for parole again and they say, well, why haven't you done your drug and alcohol program? And the inmate just says, well, they won't put me in it. and then the other issue is that they never get a date certain of what is a sufficient amount of time. So is the sufficient amount of time 10 years? Is it your maximum sentence? Is it 50%, 80% of your sentence? No one will say. It's just a very amorphous thing. And so there's very little that any inmate can do to help improve their chances for parole.
How do officials decide who gets parole and who doesn't?
That's a really great question. As far as I can tell, those are the three standards that they use, the three standards that I just described. And I have not been able to get any of the parole commissioners to actually do an interview with me. But I did hear a recording of a meeting that they had with some religious activists who are trying to get this changed. And one of those parole commissioners, Steve Landerman, did say, you know, well, I can't tell you you're going to be out in 2 years. That's just not how it works. But he didn't actually say how it does work. And their explanation is so many fewer people are being paroled because that pool of people eligible for parole is getting smaller since truth in sentencing people don't have parole as an option. But when you look at the numbers, the percentages are still way out of whack.
So to look at your bigger question about the role of rehabilitation in prison, in Wisconsin, where are we on that question? What do we think is the ultimate goal of serving time in prison?
Well, I think you get a lot of disagreement on that, depending on who you ask. You know, some people say it's punishment. You know, I've heard back from a lot of readers who have said not only should Ramiah not be out, Shane shouldn't be out either. Because, you know, if you take somebody else's life, you should be locked up forever and throw the key away. And then there are other people who say, you know, it's society's obligation to give people who are willing to improve themselves another chance out in the world. You know, a lot of inmates have said to me, think about the worst thing you've ever done, the worst mistake you've ever made in your life, and that is the absolute only thing you're judged by for the rest of your life. I mean, that's tough. So people say rehabilitation is a goal, but if he's been rehabilitated, why is he still there? And if he hasn't been rehabilitated, tell him what he needs to do in order to become rehabilitated.
And then briefly, as we wrap up, do we know what the prospects are for Ramiah Whiteside being released from prison?
Well, I just talked to him earlier today, and he is going to be starting his drug and alcohol treatment program in 4 weeks. He's got a slot. He signed a contract, and that's the last thing that the parole board has been telling him for 20 years that he needs to do. So he'll be starting that in 4 weeks, and he's up for another parole review in June. So there's no guarantee, but that's when they'll reconsider his request for release.
Gina, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome.
We've been speaking to Gina Barton, criminal justice investigative reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She was with us to talk about two cases with different outcomes in Wisconsin's legal system.